For the 2011 update for ICD-10-CM, obviously we will be making changes based on the October 1st, 2010 ICD-9-CM changes as we normally do. And there are a good number of the ICD-9-CM changes for 2010 that actually weren't already represented in ICD-10-CM, so you will see those changes. Additionally, and many of you may not know this, when we update ICD-10-CM, we also update it to include the revisions that have been made by the World Health Organization to the WHO ICD-10. They also have a parallel updating process. So as they update and create new codes and also make modifications, we also move those changes where appropriate into ICD-10-CM. Fortunately, this year we don't have a number of new codes coming over from WHO, and some of the changes that they did for approve for October 2009 actually included some new codes that were based on things that were already in ICD-10-CM. So we're fortunate in that regard that we didn't get a huge body of work. Other changes for ICD-10-CM update includes revisions to instructional notes and descriptors for consistency and standardization of code titles. And some of those suggestions were actually submitted by several of you, some of who may be in the audience or on the telephone. The standardization of the code titles will be basically an ongoing endeavor. Well, we couldn't do everything given the number of codes, but we did start with modifications to codes related to laterality and to the 0.8 other. But again, these will be ongoing modifications, and thank all of you who submitted recommendations for changes. And also for industry feedback, I'd like to thank, as Pat did, AHIMA, for bringing forward a number of very helpful suggestions that have come through the academies, and that's been very helpful. And we've received a lot of input from others in the audience, and though we usually don't necessarily indicate a particular person, one who has been very prolific and that I would like to acknowledge is Kathy Myrick. Thank you, Kathy. Your eye for detail has been excellent, as has Linda Holtzman. I've got a body of work to prove how much time they've been devoting to this. So again, thank you both. So what we will be posting in January, or perhaps a little bit sooner, will be updated files, and these will be for the tabular list, the alphabetic index for diseases and injuries, updates to the table of neoplasms and the table of drugs and chemicals, also updates to the external cause of injury index. Cooperating parties will be working on updates to the ICD-10-CM guidelines. Again, we've received a lot of input and feedback from a number of folks who have already looked at this in some detail, and some have been approaching me at some of the meetings, and so I ask when you do that, please remember to send an email so that we make sure that we're capturing everything that is of concern to you. I won't go into the updates on the general equivalence maps because I think we've covered that quite keenly in previous discussions. And again, for those who had were going to make comments about the GEMS but also had some possible recommendations for updates to 10CM, we would welcome those. And we would just ask that you please separate them to make it easier to identify which things are GEMS and which things really relate to ICD-10CM itself, so that we can possibly bring those forward to future meetings of the Coordination and Maintenance Committee. Couple of other things, and let me just go back to this slide if I... Okay, let me go to the left. Oops. Thank you, Charlie. Nope, did it again. One of the things that I... Several things that I did not include in terms of what we will be posting related to ICD-10-CM updates. In addition to the PDF files for ICD-10-CM that you've all seen, we are planning to post machine-readable files in XML. We've gotten a lot of calls and emails about, I see the heads nodding, okay. We've gotten a lot of calls requesting other formats because I know PDF is quite difficult to work with, if for some, not almost impossible. So we will be bringing those files forward for this year. The long descriptions, obviously Pat has just covered information about the short descriptors, but the full code title files will also be available on the website, and we'll be updating the user guide for the GEMs as appropriate based on any changes that we make to the GEM files this year. And then working with Rhonda, we've also identified that, you know, there may be some additional language that we can include to help make it easier for people to understand the use of the GEMs, and maybe some enhancements to specifically identify anything that you think is lacking or not well-defined within the user guide. For tomorrow, and this is a kind of like, please come back tomorrow, there have been a lot of comments made about some other changes that industry would like to see in ICD-10-CM, and for those of you who have gone up on the website and seen our topic package, I think you have noted that there are a number of ICD-10-CM related proposals that will be discussed for tomorrow. Those proposals will not be part of the 2011 update, but will be looked at toward the October 1, 2011 update. So, again, please come back, or if you're not able to attend tomorrow, please go back to the website, look at the proposals, and give us your comments in writing. And some other things that were also noted for change, and again, just so you all didn't think that we thought question marks were appropriate ways of denoting things in the classification, we actually had some gremlins creep in. Special characters were somehow interestingly displayed with question marks. So you'll see that there will be a lot of error corrections in that way, and typos and such. So you know, we're very happy to have had all the comments that we've received come to us, and we encourage you to continue to provide us your comment so that we can make the classification the best that it can be. And with that, I don't have any additional information. So from the floor, if there are any questions, I'd be pleased to take the questions.
Thanks, Donna. David Friedman again with the American Podiatric Medical Association. Quick question. If we provide this information that I reviewed earlier and it does not show up going forward, and we still have concerns that there are issues with what's being printed in the an online file, how do we then again re-bring up the same issue again if we think that they're being overlooked, or who do we address that to? Is it still to you?
Yes, you would address that to me. And again, it appears that you've already, you know, got a large body of work. The sooner that you can get that to us, the better. Clearly, it can't be presented tomorrow, but the deadline for proposals for the March 2011 meeting is in January. So if you could find the time to incorporate all of that and send it to us, you know, that would be great. It would also allow us time to actually be back in touch with you if we had questions.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, one more question, or possibly two.
Kathy Myrick, wearing the other hat as instructor at San Diego Mesa Community College. I see that we're now moving things on to the fiscal year for updates. So for our students and getting ready to have books for them, when you say it's available for October 1, 2011, will that be out to the publishers like we have it in June this year for the addenda, or are we still, you know, still trying to cycle into that?
I think there's still room for discussion there, but Kathy, I would love to hear what your thoughts are about that. I mean, if you're prepared to make them now, that would be good, but don't want to put you on the spot. So if you wanted to send us something in writing.
Yeah, I'll send something in writing.
Okay.
Thanks.
Stephanie Stinchcomb, American Urological Association. I know we've talked about the GEMs all morning, and you're asking for input from us, and since it's up there, I figured I would say a little. you know, from what I've seen, all I see is are the codes themselves. Is there any way, and I don't know how difficult it would be, to put a short descriptor with those so it would make it easier for us instead of having to go back and forth between the books?
Stephanie, I'm not sure I'm understanding it.
Okay.
For the GEMS, you're talking about having short descriptors as part of?
Okay, you know, the GEMS files that we post are the logic, and we also, both of us, agencies, post separate full titles, and we will be posting separately abbreviated titles. We in HHS aren't in the business of making tools for you to use.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can obviously merge those yourself, but we hear what you say, but I don't know that we will be making various versions for you to add as a standalone user tool. Probably the thing you're talking about is what some vendors are planning to do, make something more user-friendly, and they do that with groupers and encoders and whatever, and they should do that. What we do is we come up with the final GEM logic and code title. So we don't have a plan to modify that to make it more of an advanced tool for you to use.
All right. Thank you.
If there are no other questions on the floor, moderator, could you open up the phone line for questions?
If you would like to ask a question from the phone, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad, and we'll pause for just a moment to compile the roster. Your first question comes from the line of Pat King from the South Carolina Department of Mental Health. Your line is open.
Thank you for taking my call. What I was going to ask about is the DSM-4 PR codes that we use. Is there a mapping available using those codes? Or do we have to continue? Oh, we bill with ICD-9, but we still use the DSM-4 codes.
I'm not aware that anyone is doing a mapping between DSM-4 and ICD-10-CM, but there is someone in the audience who may be able to help me with that question, and that is Dr. Daryl Regeer from the American Psychiatric Association, and he is moving to the microphone.
Thank you.
Hi, yes, Daryl Regeer from the APA. You know, we are currently working on the DSM-5, and I've been in touch with Donna about trying to anticipate the DSM-5 changes in time for the ICD-10-CM, and we've been working with the WHO, Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse, that is also working on the ICD-11. So we will have something ready to propose to Donna that would be coming in probably in November at the earliest and certainly in January for any particular changes. Now, in terms of a coding trans, kind of a crosswalk between the current DSM-4 and the ICD-10-CM, the ICD-10-CM essentially incorporates the DSM-4 names and already has in it the, I would say, probably 99% of the translations that would be appropriate. We actually published an international version of the DSM-4 back in the early 1990s. When ICD-10 was available so that international colleagues could use the definitions in the DSM and apply them to the ICD-10. So the crosswalk has essentially been ready since the early 1990s for the major codes in the current ICD-10. Our hope is, as I said, that we would be able to actually make a modification to that current ICD-10 for the ICD-10-CM implementation which takes place in October 1st, 2013, about 4 months after the May 2013 release of the DSM-5.
Thank you, Dr. Regeer. Were there any other questions online?
There are no further questions from the phone.
Okay. There's one more question, Dr. Friedman.
Thank you. I got a text from my association. They want to know why we're going to ICD-10 and not going to ICD-11.
That's always a fun question. Okay, let me give you a little background on how ICD-10-CM is developed and how that would relate to an ICD-11. WHO in the past has released their published version of the ICD, after which it is evaluated by different member states, including the U.S., to see if that version is actually detailed enough for what each country uses it for. So for ICD-10, when it was released by WHO, we had a roughly 2-year evaluation of ICD-10 to determine whether or not ICD-10, as published by WHO, would actually work for us here in the U.S. for all of the reasons we currently use it. And no, it didn't. And so we spent, obviously, a number of years working on modifications to ICD-10-CM to make it useful for use in the U.S. A similar process would have to be followed for ICD-11. And while I know they are looking to make it more expansive, at its core, it's still primarily a mortality-based classification, which doesn't work for all of the morbidity applications that we would need here in the U.S. for administrative, financial transactions, quality benchmarking, statistical purposes. NCHS is a statistical agency. So the number of purposes that a clinical modification would be used for in the U.S., ICD-11 would have to be evaluated for that as well. Now, the current timetable, I believe, for ICD-11 is 2014 to the World Health Assembly, which basically means it wouldn't roll out for another 2 years after that. If you were to wait and try to continue to use a very flawed ICD-9-CM in anticipation of an ICD-11, which still might need clinical modification for here in the U.S., I can stand here and tell you that there is nothing that I could continue to do to ICD-9-CM to make it useful for all the purposes that are currently used for. What we will be guided by what WHO is doing. The U.S. does participate in that work. The North American Collaborating Center for ICD and ICF is housed at NCHS. So we will be working closely with WHO in the formation of what is in ICD-11, but it will also give us a benefit of seeing what may be going into ICD-11 that could find its way into ICD-10-CM simultaneously. Were there any other questions? Okay, well, I'm going to turn the podium back over to Pat.
Thank you. Well, you've done well. We've completed our ICD-10 part this morning, and since we do have the phone lines for another half hour, we're actually going to move to our first ICD-9-CM topic. But before we do that, I would like to introduce a new member of our staff. If Celeste Beauregard would please stand up. We are really pleased, because we feel like we're overworked, to have Celeste join our group. She's going to be doing coding and DRG issues. And in addition, she's going to be the lead analyst on our staff for hospital-acquired conditions. So those of you who have a chance during the meeting might want to step up and meet Celeste during a break. Okay, so we are now going to invite Amy Gruber to come to the podium, and she's going to be discussing implantable hemodynamic monitoring system. This issue can be found on page 38 of your handout,
The issue is, effective October 1st, 2006, two new procedure codes were created to identify the intracardiac hemodynamic monitoring system, code 00.56, insertion or replacement of implantable pressure sensor lead and parens for intracardiac or great vessel hemodynamic monitoring, and code 00.57, implantation or replacement of subcutaneous device for intracardiac or great vessel hemodynamic monitoring. These codes identify the two components of a system that are implantable, the insertion of the sensor and the implantation of the monitor subcutaneously. Effective October 1st, 2009, the terms or great vessel was added to the code title to include other sites where the sensor may be inserted. Newer systems are being developed where one component of the system is implantable. Only the sensor is implanted into a great vessel. An external monitor is used to communicate wirelessly with the sensor. Question before you is, should new codes be created to distinguish between these monitoring systems? There will be a new tech application for this system, and the requester is requesting an October 2011 implementation date if approved. Here to provide us with clinical presentation about the system is Dr. Jay Yadav, who is the CEO of CardioMEMS. Dr. Yadav?
Thank you, Amy. I appreciate getting squeezed in before lunchtime. A lot of people left. It's really not going to be that boring. I'm going to try to make it interesting. And I'll go fairly fast so you can all get to lunch. Most of my talk will really be focused on the clinical trial that we completed this year with some very exciting results. I'll give you some background on heart failure also and the nature of our technology. So CardioMEMS has been around since 2001. It's based in Atlanta on the Georgia Tech campus. The fundamental technology comes from Georgia Tech and MIT, and the basic science was funded by the Department of Defense for creating a new type of wireless sensing technology for the inside of jet engines. It turns out that in that location, in that temperature and pressure, you really can't use traditional sensors or wire connections. And I found that very interesting. I'm a cardiologist, but I found that very interesting because we would really like to be able to put things like that in the human body also that don't require us to put in leads and other things, which we know we have issues with over time. So that's what made it very interesting for us. And we were able to license that technology from Georgia Tech and MIT and then use that as a foundation for CardioMEMS. I think most of you are familiar with the nature of heart failure and the scope of the problem. It really is a large problem. There are about 6 million people in the U.S. with heart failure, about 700,000 new cases each year, over 1 million hospitalizations, and it's very expensive also. The total cost is about $40 billion. Hospitalizations by themselves are about $20 billion. So it's really a big public health clinical problem. And heart failure hospitalizations really are at the center of it. From a clinical perspective, what I noticed back in around 1998, 2000, when I started thinking about this, was really that I was having more and more of my patients in the hospital more and more frequently for heart failure. And they'd end up in the CCU, in the ICU. And this was just a recurring, it was very traumatic for the patient, and it was very burdensome for our hospital also. So how do you go about reducing heart failure hospitalization? This clearly people have thought about this for quite a while, and a lot of work has been done on this. And there are many different approaches. Certainly increased clinical management, using call centers, calling patients, intensifying the interaction with nurses and doctors. That can work. It tends to be rather intensive, labor-intensive, and, you know, we have a nursing shortage already. So it's not been feasible to apply that broadly, and it's not clear if it's cost-effective. Other means, such as measuring impedance in the skin or BNP, have not been shown in randomized trials to reduce heart failure hospitalizations. What I came back to was the right heart catheterization that we do. So if you get sick with heart failure and you're in the hospital, we will very frequently do what's called a right heart catheterization, or Swan-Ganz catheter after Dr. Swan and Ganz, which is a catheter which goes into the heart in the pulmonary artery and measures the pressures and cardiac output in the heart. And this is a very precise way to figure out in that patient what is going on. Because it is often difficult for us, by examining a patient, listening to their lungs, et cetera, to really tell where they are and what treatment do they need. Because remember, they're already on a lot of medication, so it's not like we can just put them on new medication. So that's what we typically do. So the question that I asked was there any conceivable way we could get that type of right heart catheter information all the time? Because we can only do a right heart catheterization in the ICU or cath lab. And it seemed like a crazy question, but we worked on that and we were able to get that type of information that we'd get in the cath lab now every day from the patient's home. That's what CardioMEMS technology is all about. So the whole thesis behind CardioMEMS is that having this information comparable to the right heart cath, pulmonary artery pressure monitoring on a daily basis from the patient's home would allow the doctors and nurses to manage these patients better and prevent them from decompensating ending up in the hospital. That was the idea which we tested in this clinical trial. There are three components to this system. The implantable piece is a sensor monitor which both senses information and then transmits it out, and so that's what's in the patient, in the pulmonary artery. Then outside we have an external transmitter which takes that information from the patient, it's hooked up to a phone line or wireless, cell phone type settings, and it transmits that information to a database. The database is accessible to the patient's doctor and nurses where they can see this pressure information. The clinical trial that we did, which took us about 3 years, and we just finished it this spring, and the data was presented in Berlin at the European Heart Failure Meeting. The principal investigator was Dr. Bill Abraham from Ohio State and Dr. Phil Adamson from Oklahoma. And what this study tested was, is this a safe device? Is it also efficacious in reducing heart failure hospitalizations? The primary efficacy was heart failure-related hospitalizations at 6 months. And the treatment group compared to the control group. The control group also had a sensor and also took readings, but that information was not accessible to the physicians or nurses. So the control group was managed using our current traditional metrics that we use, talking to the patient, examining the patient. The treatment group had the traditional information, but in addition, this pulmonary artery pressure information. This was done at 64 centers in the U.S. All patients, as I said, got a sensor, and after the sensor implant, they were randomized to the treatment or control groups, and they were all followed in a blinded fashion until the last patient reached 6 months. The major eligibility criteria were as follows. Let's just focus on the top two. They had to have class 3 heart failure, and they had to be an optimal pharmacological therapy, which is defined by the ACC and AHA, ACE inhibitors, ARBs, beta blockers, there are clear guidelines for that. And they had to have a hospitalization for heart failure within the last year. Those are the major two criteria. The rest are more, we don't need to go into those, but the first two are the major criteria. The safety was measured in two ways. One was freedom from device system-related complications, which the FDA set at the 80% level, meaning 80% of the patients could not have a device system-related complication. And then the second one was the failure of the implantable component, which the FDA set at the 90% level. So 90% of these devices had to be working at the 6-month time point in the end of the trial. The efficacy endpoint was the rate of heart failure-related hospitalizations at 6 months. There are multiple secondary endpoints which are of interest to us. The change in the pressure, did the pressure go down? The number of patients hospitalized. Remember, the primary endpoint is the number of hospitalizations. One could also look at the number of patients being hospitalized because many of these patients have more than one hospitalization. Days alive outside the hospital and quality of life, as you're familiar with. This is the overall flow of the trial. 550 patients are implanted, 270 in the treatment group, 280 in the control group, and the primary endpoint that discussed. Now, because we followed the patients until the last patient reached 6 months, we actually ended up with a lot more follow-up than 6 months. So the average follow-up in the trial was actually 15 months. So we have some longer-term data on these patients, which I think is very helpful. Just looking at the baseline demographics, the age is about 60, so the patients keep getting younger as I keep getting older. The typical distribution that we see in heart failure trials, many of the patients did have devices, if you notice CRT or ICD devices, and many of them were on appropriate medications, which are the diuretics, the ACE inhibitors, and beta blockers. And the two groups were well balanced. The two groups are quite similar in these types of treatments at baseline. Here's the primary safety endpoint. If we just look at the last column, all patients, there were 8 device system-related complications, or 1.4%, so much lower than the 80% bar set by the FDA, so it's highly statistically significant. The second one was failure of the device. Did you have to go back in and replace the device? None of the patients had to have the device replaced. All the devices were functioning, which is pretty unusual for cardiac devices, and in my experience, and yours too, I'm sure. So that was highly significant at the P less than 0.01 level. Now, for the efficacy, was there a benefit to the treatment group? At the 6-month primary endpoint, there were 83 hospitalizations for heart failure in the treatment group and 120 in the control group. So a dramatic reduction in the number of hospitalizations, which was highly significant, a very low p-value. Then we followed them out, as I said, out to 15 months with the average follow-up, and what was reassuring was that at 15 months, the number of hospitalizations in the treatment group was 153. In the control group, it was 253. So the difference actually got bigger over time. Not only the treatment was robust, sustainable, and actually seemed to be more efficacious, and that was also highly significant. The last column there is NNT, or number needed to treat, and you may be familiar with that calculation. It wasn't required by the FDA, but it's a common calculation, particularly in Europe, looking at cost effectiveness and societal cost of technology. So this is the number of patients you need to treat to prevent one event. Okay, so at the 6-month time point is 8 patients. At the 15 months is 4 patients. These are really low number needed to treat. Most devices and drugs that we use are in the 20, 30, 40 type of patient number needed to treat. So it suggests that as a public health application, this is an efficient solution. Because you could have a clinical trial, for example, where you have a big relative risk reduction, but the disease is infrequent, i.e. it occurs twice in a million patients. You cut it down to 1 in a million patients, so you have a 50% reduction, but your number needed to treat is 1 million patients. So that's just to give you some perspective. This is a graphical representation of this data. So what we see is that starting really about 3 months, the groups started to diverge. At 6 months, there's a significant divergence, which continues over time. So over time, the treatment group continues to do better than the control group, and it's a sustainable benefit. For some of the secondary endpoints, the first one was reduction in pressure, and I'll show you a graph that helps explain that a little bit better. But what happened over time is that if we took 0 as the baseline when the patient entered the trial, what happens over time? So minus number means that their pressure went down over time, plus means it actually kept going up. So the treatment group had a reduction in pressure overall, and the control group had a continued slight increase in pressure, which is what one expects from the natural history of heart failure. The second one is the number of patients hospitalized, and there were 54 in the treatment group and 80 in the control group. So not only do we have a reduction in the number of hospitalizations, but also in the number of patients being hospitalized, which is also significant. And the last one is the number of days alive outside the hospital, 6 months. This is a little complicated analysis, but this is the number of patients staying out of the hospital and staying alive. And that also was higher in the treatment group and then the control group at 6 months. And the last one is the Minnesota Quality of Life for Heart Failure Questionnaire. And the treatment group did report feeling better than the control group, as one would expect. This is the pressure curve that I mentioned to you. And what you're seeing, the blue line is control, and the dashed line is baseline, where they come into the study. And what you notice is that the control group tends to drift slightly up over time, and the treatment group's pressures go down over time. One other important question is, well, okay, you're reducing heart failure hospitalization, but are you increasing other hospitalization? Are you causing some collateral unexpected side effect? And we're used to seeing that in medicine, particularly cardiology. You know, it's like a balloon. You push on it in one spot and it bulges out somewhere else, right? So we really wanted to test for that. And what you see here is if you look at the bold lines here, at 6 months, the non-heart failure hospitalizations were the same in both groups. So above that you see HFR is heart failure related hospitalizations, which is much lower in the treatment group, but the non-heart failure hospitalizations did not go up in the treatment group. There's no compensatory increase in other types of events happening. Similarly, at all days at the bottom, you again see that the non-heart failure hospitalizations are essentially the same in both arms. So in conclusion, the clinical trial, the trial met its primary safety endpoint very strongly, as well as the efficacy endpoint very strongly. There was a 30% reduction in heart failure hospitalization at 6 months, and a 38% reduction at the all-day time period, which is approximately 15 months. Some of the secondary measures that the FDA was interested in were also positive in regard to pressure, the number of patients being hospitalized, and quality of life. So this slide kind of ties it all together. You have a sequence of events where the pressure information is used by the doctors and nurses to manage medications, which leads to a pulmonary artery pressure reduction, which leads to a hospitalization reduction, which also, as an ancillary benefit, the patient feels better. Let me just describe to you in conclusion the technology before I turn it back over to Amy. So historically, for cardiac electrical devices, we've had a two-part implantable. We've had a can and a lead, and they work together. What we have done with this technology, and this sensor, by the way, is made on a wafer. It is the first fully chip-type device for medical devices. So it's like a chip in your laptop, et cetera. It has no moving components to it. So what we have done is combine those pieces into one device. Both the sensing and the monitoring aspects are combined into one implantable device. And so here, just to make it more obvious here, so you've got the implantable component, which is the CardioMEMS device has those features to it, traditional devices, and then outside the patient, you've got a transmitter, which is used to communicate with the device, which is the intermediary between the device and the patient and the database that resides at CardioMEMS and is accessed through a secure web-based platform by the doctors and nurses. So that's all I have. I'm happy to answer any questions, or I'll turn it over to Amy.
We will now move on to the coding options, and then we will open up the floor for comments or questions for the doctor. There are two coding options there before you. Option one is to not create a new code, continue to assign procedure codes 00.56 and 00.57 for the implantable hemodynamic monitoring system. Option two would be to create a new code under category 38.2, diagnostic procedures on blood vessels, for the insertion of the implantable wireless pressure sensor. The next available code in 38 would be 38.26, and the title would be insertion of implantable wireless pressure sensor for intracardiac or great vessel hemodynamic monitoring. There are several inclusion terms which would identify that it is a combination wireless pressure sensor and internal monitor. It identifies that it will be implanted into a great vessel or branch thereof, as well as it identifies that it doesn't have batteries or leads. And the standard exclusion notes that would appear under the new code appear currently under 00.56. CMS's recommendation at this time is option two. I'd like to open up the floor for any comments.
This is more of a question. This new device is wireless, so there are no leads at all, and that's why the new code says without batteries or leads. So then the interim coding would only be for the subcutaneous device rather than both codes with one with the lead insertion? I mean, right? So it would only be one code in terms of the interim coding.
For the total system, to identify that, it is a total system in that it is a combination of the sensor and internal monitoring. The best thing that we can suggest at this time would be to code both.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm not understanding, and forgive me because this is, you know, it's wireless mm-hmm. and there's no leads. So in the interim coding, why would you use a code for insertion of leads?
To identify the sensor aspect as well as the internal monitor aspect. This is what we've identified as the best codes available at this time. Pat's going to provide you further guidance.
All right.
Yep, Nellie, we would be happy for you to suggest if you feel like this bad interim advice. It's a tricky situation because this one device contains two things. So we were thinking for now, we don't want people to believe you're simply putting in a device and the patient doesn't have any leads. It sounds like a replacement of the old one. And we didn't know what to do to substitute for a total unit. So that's our best guess of an interim thing. And then the new code would be more clear because it would show there's no need to code a separate device lead because you're not putting one in. But you're correct. We did struggle with this concept. And we would love to have you discuss. And if you even wanted to put this on the cutting clinic agenda for November to discuss interim advice, we'd be happy to discuss
it
some more.
Yeah, because I think it's a little bit confusing because if you hear there's no leads and, you know, the description talks about wireless, that's why I was sort of thinking, where is the coder going to make the leap to say, I also need to assign a code for the lead insertion, even though
you're right.
Wireless.
It's a problematic area
right now.
All
right, thank you.
Linda Holkman, yes. Clarity Coding. In the interest of full disclosure, I want to point out that I sometimes do consulting for Medtronic, including the cardiac rhythm management division, which, by the way, the picture of the old technology was actually a Medtronic device. So it seems reasonable to me to have a new code for this. I mean, it is very different technology, and especially since the applicant is looking for a new tech add-on, then you'd need a new code. So that's fine. My issue is the wording on the code to make the distinctions between 3826 and the older technology more clear.
Okay.
As the doctor went through his presentation, and as I saw, and as you then discussed the inclusion notes, it started to become clear to me. But when I first looked at this, I was like, what's the difference? So I'm not sure I have any specific wording at this point, though I'll probably write to you, but I think we need to do something with the wording here to make it more clear. Also, I think we're going to need something, some kind of revision to the code description on 0056 and maybe an exclusion note on 0056 or on 0057 to make clear that these are related but distinct devices. Also, I'm with Nellie. I have a lot of concerns on the interim coding.
Okay.
You know, in some ways, I'd be more inclined to just use 0056 by itself, even though that code is defined as lead. It also is defined as sensor. So if I were to see this new device, I would probably say, okay, well, it's a sensor and it's in there, so I'll use the 0056. Then I would really be troubled to use the 0057. I realize the new device has a monitor associated with it, but 0057 is specifically for inserting something in a subcutaneous pocket, and that's not happening here. So I'm not sure what to do with that either, but that's a real issue.
We understand your concerns.
And I'm David Berglund with CDC NCHS, and just had a couple of comments. A comment related to Nellie's comment. I would imagine that this device in some ways would act like the tip of the lead in that it has the sensor in it, but yet it's got everything in one place. So we're seeing the whole device a lot smaller, as I understand, than what we would have had in the past, which does make for a little different way of looking at things. I was a little curious about how long the batteries would last in this and what would happen to it when they ran out. Would it be replaced using a similar approach? Do we need a code for replacement too? Or would we use the same code? I was curious about that. I don't know how long the device would last. or anything. If we had comments on that, I'd be interested, and on how we'd code if it needed replacing.
Thank you. Thanks, Amy. That's a great question, and I actually don't know. It doesn't have a battery. So for that, that limitation doesn't exist. In the clinical trial, we had patients, I think the longest patient was out 3.5 years, and feasibility of that patients were out almost 5 years. So now I'm not saying that it never would need replacing. I'm sure, everything needs to be replaced. But it isn't a part of, it doesn't have a built-in requirement to be replaced. So I will leave it up to the coding experts on that one, but that's the medical perspective.
I have a clinical question then.
Yes.
Just out of curiously, if it doesn't have a battery, it's Linda Holtzman. I'm just curious, if it doesn't have a battery, how is it powered?
It stores energy, so it has a capacitor. It stores energy inside the device.
Solar energy?
No, from the external transmitter.
Oh, the external transmitter. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Sue Bowman from HEMA. Response to the to follow up on the previous comments about distinguishing this from the older technology. When you're looking at the rewording of the code, I would also suggest looking at the wording of the last excludes note that's being proposed, because when you read that, that sounds very similar to the new code descriptor with the omission of the word wireless. So it's kind of like, okay, insertion of implantable pressure sensor for et cetera, that's what this is. So I think there needs to be more wording there, too, to just make it really clear what the difference between this code is and the older codes.
And we welcome your suggestions on the rewording. we struggled with that combo versus non-combo. So, any other questions or comments? Operator, at this time, can you please open up the phone lines?
If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. And we'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. There are no questions from the phones.
Thank you.
Okay, everyone, we will now break for lunch, and we'll start back up again at 1:30. And I want to remind everyone on the telephone to please refer to your agenda for the ID number for the afternoon, which is different than for the morning. So we'll see you back here at 1:30.